Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's June 9th, 2016, 9th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin shared this 14-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 1, Enforcement Trends and Issues. Mary Jo Gillette and Amy Greer will discuss current and important enforcement trends and issues in the hedge fund industry. Now, on to the podcast.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks so much for coming. My name is Amy Greer, and Mary Jo and I practice in Morgan Lewis's securities enforcement and litigation practice. We're here today to talk about enforcement trends and issues. Without further ado, the SEC brought a record number of new cases in the last fiscal year, and a record number of penalties and disgorgement were collected by the staff. You know, we sort of make light of this, but $4.2 billion, it's a lot of money. And they are very successful at getting people to settle with them, and for good reason. No one especially wants to proceed to a trial in an enforcement action well into the 90 percentile of cases settle. Only 6 cases were tried in federal court last year. 20-something cases went into administrative proceedings, but that's out of hundreds and hundreds of cases. 2015 was the year of the whistleblower. The whistleblower program is now 5 years old, the program established by Dodd-Frank. And the agency gets somewhere just shy of 4,000 tips, complaints, and referrals each year and makes much of them. They talk much about them. You know, I think over the course of 5 years of the program being in operation, I think they've paid a total of 23 whistleblowers. They don't really trumpet that nearly as much as the number of tips, complaints, and referrals. And people don't want to hear about that. They want to hear that they, too, can get a lottery ticket. But the SEC takes this program very seriously. They believe that it's leading to important cases. And last year, the focus on whistleblower sort of documentation within firms that might chill whistleblowers from communicating with the staff took up a lot of people's time, energy, and effort out following up on the KBR case.
So we're just going to spend a couple minutes talking about some of the themes that we saw in enforcement in 2015 and then address what we think may be coming based on talking about some specific cases that came out in the last 12 months. But first, themes that were high priority in the enforcement program last year and which we think will continue to be so in the upcoming year is a focus on gatekeeper accountability. There have been some public speeches made about that by high-level agency officials, and they are sort of a renewed commitment to trying to seek out and bring case enforcement actions against gatekeepers, and you will hear about some of those when we talk about some specific cases. Also, and we talked about this last year on the enforcement panel, they continue to increase their effective use of data analytics, and they continue to inform how they set their priorities and how they identify firms that they may want to really look into in greater depth in determining whether, in fact, an enforcement action may be appropriate. As I said, I think we talked about this last year. They did publish at the end of their fiscal year 2015 that they took on 120 projects that related to supporting enforcement efforts in all areas of the enforcement program. Another high priority for them is cybersecurity. They have identified somebody within the agency as sort of, they don't really publicize this, but as sort of their cybersecurity czar, and that is David Glockner, who is the head of the Chicago office. David came out of the U.S. Attorney's Office, where he worked for many, many years on the criminal side and was one of the early folks identified by Maine Justice to develop thinking around cybersecurity and cyber breach on the criminal side before he came to the SEC. They've brought 2 cases in this area so far, Both of the cases were charged as violations of Regulation SP and Rule 30A within that regulation, which specifically speaks to having written policies and procedures designed to safeguard personally identifiable information and other information. So that is going to continue to be a focus, and I would say if you haven't already done it, take a look and review your policies and procedures so that you're not vulnerable on that front. Insider trading continues to be of interest and I think will continue to be of interest going forward. They brought a number of market integrity cases, primarily focusing in some of the newer areas on ATS and on dark pool cases. And then, of course, their continuing interest in and allocation of resources to pursuing and bringing enforcement actions against investment advisors. Investment companies.
So before we move from some of these mentioned items from last year and the continuation into this year, I just wanted to say this focus on data has really changed the game at the SEC. And for this audience in particular, this idea that the staff can focus on something as simple as what they view to be aberrant performance and take from that, having pulled data from a lot of firms and considered the marketplace in their view, looking at aberrant returns and then sort of reverse engineering what they view as being an investigation of registrants across. They come to the firm that they believe may have committed a violation last. They're looking around at the people who are potentially invested in your firm. They look at all of the regulated entities that they can, and then they would come to the firm with the aberrant returns last. And they will then ask, how are you getting this? What are you doing? What, tell us. And it's a very complicated position to be in, to have a conversation with the SEC when they have an awful lot of information about your firm. On the simpler side, because they get so much trading information, you know, they've brought these cherry-picking cases where they can look at the day's trading and make determinations about whether or not trading has been fairly allocated between and among various funds within a group of funds. And these are cases that are very hard to defend. They are what they are. And the staff knows the answers to the questions really before they're asking them.
Right. And I would just add this. Part of the use of the data starts way before the enforcement process. So it is informing many of the examination initiatives. A lot of these large sweep initiatives that you may hear about or read about are flowing out of work that has first been done with data by DERA, the Division of Economic and Risk Analysis. And in some instances, so while this does not relate directly to this audience, but it's a great example, by the time they get to you, as Amy says, you can be really locked in. So for example, right now, they are looking at a number of investment advisors in enforcement on the heels of examinations who received what they are terming performance advertising materials from F Squared. And we saw them bring the case against F Squared last fall. They then brought the big case against Virtus, who settled in December. But here's the thing. F Squared admitted as part of its settlement with the SEC that these performance figures were false and based on back testing. So if you happen to be the investment advisor down the line that they're now getting to, you don't have a lot of wiggle room in terms of coming up with a defense there because they've already locked that pretty critical piece in a very strong and compelling piece of evidence before a fact finder.
The other thing about it is it's not like there's some requirement that they come up with a novel or new strategy for charging these cases. You know, one of the things that hampers the SEC more than anything is the fact that they're dealing with often new and novel products and new and novel types of trading, but we're still dealing with the 33 Act, the 34 Act, and the 40 Act. But the fact is that the cases against the ATSs, the case against the dark pool, these were straight disclosure cases. These were straight fraud cases. They were charged as such. This was the type of conduct that we've seen charged a million times, down to its most basic. One of these cases was a marking the close case. One of these cases was a straight, you told your clients one thing, you did something else. At their core, they're really very basic cases. And I think that as we discuss the cases most relevant to this audience, we're going to see more of the same. Mary Jo and I are always saying, oh, everything's a fraud case. But it's true.
Or a violation of the compliance rule if they can't make the fraud case.
Exactly.
Which is the opposite end of the continuum from the staff's standpoint.
So we think that it's important to point out, particularly for this audience, that a number of the cases that have been brought so far against hedge funds this year have arisen out of examinations. And these are pretty recent examinations. It's pretty likely that they were probably not that prepared for the examinations, not knowing what to expect. Now, some of them are, again, just plain fraud, but let's talk about them.
Okay. So we're going to talk, the first three cases that we're just going to touch upon all came out of examination referrals. The first one, and it's the oldest one, it's from a little over 1 year ago that we're going to talk about, is the Alpha Titan case. This case ultimately could be boiled down to a failure to disclose that assets of affiliates of the private fund were used to pay a number of expenses, including things you would expect need to be paid, operations expenses, salaries, rent, other types of things, and this was not disclosed. This was a case that was brought by the asset management unit, and it's the only case we're going to talk about today that actually came out of the unit. They charged the firm, they charged three individuals, and the sanctions that they sought and obtained were requiring the firm to pay approximately $500,000 in disgorgement and prejudgment interest and a $200,000 penalty. But when you get to the individuals, two of the individuals charged were given a one-year bar from the securities industry, period. One of those individuals was also an attorney and received a one-year suspension, not from practicing and appearing before the commission, from being able to represent as a client any regulated entity or person. And the third person was the accountant who had reviewed and said, given the opinion that the financials were fairly represented the financial health of the fund. And he only had to pay a $75,000 penalty, but he had to agree to a three-year suspension from practicing and appearing before the commission as part of his settlement.
The other thing that I would note about this case is that there's been a lot of talk very recently about non-GAAP compliant financial reporting. And this is a case from more than a year ago where the staff noted the fact that the financial statements were non-GAAP compliant. And I think that this is a very significant issue that we're going to continue to see more about. We mostly see it currently around issuers, but that's not the case here. And so the non-GAAP compliant financial reporting here was misrepresentative of what was actually going on, and that's exactly the point that we're seeing now being made on issuer financial reporting, and was probably one of the red flags that was raised for the exam staff. But this seemed harsh for the individuals, I have to say. This is what we were talking about earlier today. For common expenses that I think most investors would expect are being paid somewhere, this seemed harsh. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I was particularly at the individual level. The next case that we wanted to touch on, because it also arose out of an exam referral, although it's unclear from the public documents whether the examiners found this in the course of a routine exam, or whether after the commission got some kind of tip that there may have been a problem, were sent in to gather evidence through the examination process before the enforcement staff moved forward, and that is Equitas. And Equitas, plain and simply, was what they charged. In the end, it didn't start out as a Ponzi scheme, or doesn't appear to have, but it, in effect, became a Ponzi scheme. It was brought as an emergency action, and currently there are preliminary injunctions in place against the firm and some of the individuals. It's ongoing in litigation. They also installed a court-ordered receiver to take over and control the assets of the fund.
Yeah, this is one of those cases where the examination of registered affiliates, I mean, Equitas was not a registered entity, but examinations of a registered affiliate and a bunch of registered advisors that recommended the Equitas fund to their clients resulted in information and documentation that permitted the staff to go in and shut this fund down.
So the sort of provocative facts that the SEC likes to trumpet are that the fund was suffering deteriorating financial conditions, and they hid that fact in terms of what was being disclosed and represented during the time that they continued to raise another $350 million from approximately 1,500 investors. So you can see why this would be of interest to the SEC just on those very narrow facts.
Right.
But the other thing that's important, and it sort of highlights an issue that I think many of you may wrestle with or may encounter if you have not already, and that is an examination team coming in and wanting to examine the records of all of the affiliates, registered or unregistered, or coming in and examining registered affiliates as a way to try to get information back to the entity, in this case, the investment pool, that was not registered. And you can see from this case how it can really have significant implications from an enforcement standpoint if they are successful in being able to obtain that information.
So this matter is still playing out in federal court. It will probably end with a whimper, like many of these emergency actions do, without any of this money left for investors. The third matter is more recent, case of Hope Advisors, which was also brought as an emergency action. In this instance, the hedge fund managers collected extra fees by managing certain trades to appear profitable at the end of the month so that they could collect their success fees. So at the end of the month, they looked profitable, and then at the beginning of the next month, not so much. So there was a large loss realized at the beginning of every month and then very profitable at the end of the month. This, of course, was not disclosed to investors, and the staff came in and discovered this during either, as Mary Jo pointed out, it's hard to know whether it was discovered during the course of an exam or whether the exam came in after the fact. Oh, actually, this was detected during an exam, so they shut them down. They've lost their access to the funds, and this matter is still open as well and in federal court.
And, you know, part of the staff's theory here is that they collected significant amounts of fees to which they weren't entitled because the way their contract was set up, they had this incentive sort of equation, and their fees were calculated based on the profitability of the assets in the funds at month end on a monthly basis.
This case also has a little bit of a extra tweak in that apparently some of this money went to a charity, which was named as a relief defendant. So that's a little tragic because at the end of the day, this charity is not going to be able to do its charitable mission and will have to refund all of those funds. The rest of the hedge fund cases that we have from this current season and crop are largely really sort of the just plain fraud department. QED Benchmark Management is a case where when the fund was started and investments were being collected, it was represented that the advisor and manager had a scientific stock picking theory that was going to be how money was going to be made. And instead, he invested in one penny stock. He failed to disclose this during the course of his capital raising, and he also failed to disclose how he was doing with that one penny stock. And so as a result, in this particular instance, it's sort of interesting. If you read the press release and the order, the big advantage, if you're going to commit a fraud like this, is to actually have the money, because he was in a position to pay back the investors. And so this matter settled. And it settled with the return of the money to the investors. It's a much nicer press release. It's a much nicer case as a result of that. You know, misleading, all of those words are there, all of those charges are there. But if you can pay the money back, the staff is much nicer about it, I think.
Well, I'll say you should have enough money to pay back, but not a lot more, because he only paid $75,000 in the civil penalty.
True.
And I'm certain that if he had had more than that based on the investor losses, they would have sought more.
If there had been investor losses.
Right. But I think they alleged that there were almost 3 million dollars in investor losses. I think that's what he was had to pay back.
But he paid it back.
Right, but he was able to pay it back. But the other thing that he had to take as a sanction was a permanent bar from any continued engagement in the securities industry. So that's not something anyone wants to have their livelihood yanked out from under them.
True.
And the last case that we'll touch on, and then I think we'll be right at the end of our time, is probably not one that many in this audience will relate to personally, or we hope not, but that is the Casperson matter. Casperson was charged both by the SEC and has been indicted criminally and likely will have to serve some time.
Just our opinion.
Right. It's my opinion. I'll own it. So, okay. This one, you know, effectively he stole the money. I mean, this is a straight out misappropriation case. And, you know, he raised all of this money.
And he raised it under false pretenses, representing right. that, I mean, there were some legitimate funds and then he had some not legitimate funds. And in connection with the not legitimate funds, that was where he found his issue.
So I think that the last thing I'll say that may be of interest to you is that in the money that was put into the non-legitimate fund, it had a name that looked very similar to a legitimate fund name, and perhaps there was some misunderstanding.
Exactly.
But he raised $95 million almost exclusively from institutional investors. So this was not a retail investor type situation by any means. I think we are out of time, so thank you very much for listening.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
To listen to other panels from the 2016 9th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.